Asheville FM on WSFM LP 103.3 in Asheville. This is The Final Straw, and I'm William Goodenough.
And I'm Bruce O'Goodness.
The show can also be heard on KXCF in Marshall, California, KWTF in Bodega Bay, California, KOWALP in Olympia, Washington, WCRSLP in Columbus, Ohio, and Berkeley Liberation Radio. Archives of this show can be heard a week after broadcast at thefinalstrawradio.noblogs.org and is podcasting at radioforall.net. You can email us at thefinalstrawradio@riseup.net with questions or comments, and you can write us snail mail at The Final Straw, care of Asheville FM, 864 Haywood Road, Asheville, North Carolina, 28806.
This week we spoke with members of Maharlika Integral Emergence, a collective in Davao. Davao is a large city in the southeast of the archipelago of Maharlika, also known as the Philippines. We talked for the hour on the emergence of anarchism in the country, anti-colonial indigenous struggle, anarcho-punk, eco-resistance, green and post-anarchism, permaculture, anti-extraction and land struggles, and much more. Maharlika Integral Emergence is a collective in Davao working with communities to promote self-care, explore autonomy, build alternatives to the deadly duo of state and capital and its ecocidal path. We apologize for the quality of the audio. At times it becomes difficult to hear the collective members due to tech issues. Check out ashevillefm.org/the-final-straw to find the blog entry for this episode, which includes hyperlinks to some of the projects and publications coming out of Maharlika.
But first, a couple of announcements. If you're in the Asheville area, we'd like to remind you that tonight, Sunday the 12th at 5 p.m., is the grand reopening of Firestorm Cafe and Books at its new location at 610 Haywood Road, at the intersection of Haywood Road and State Street in West Asheville. From their Facebook event, quote, "It's been 16 months since we closed our doors at 48 Commerce Street. We're ready to start the next chapter. Join our 7-year-old workers cooperative for a day-long celebration featuring free coffee and other giveaways, plus a 5 p.m. local author showcase."
Quote, "Located directly across State Street from Sunny Point Cafe, the new store features a unique selection of books for young folks and adults alike. Curious readers will find not only a rich assortment of titles on gardening, green living, and political radicalism, for which their co-op is already known, but also an expanded inventory of children's books, classics, and speculative fiction," unquote. More at firestorm.coop.
Also, an update on the occupation at the Che Cafe on the campus of the University of California at San Diego. On July 15th at 2 p.m., there will be a meeting with UCSD Chancellor Kozla. For the first time, representatives of the Che Cafe Collective and CCSN will meet with Kozla to see if he will call off the eviction. Che supporters are calling for a big crowd to rally outside the meeting. It's requested that you come if you can and spread the word if you can't. Directions to the office of the chancellor are at www.act.ucsd.edu/maps. Enter search for the office of the chancellor, and the address is University Center 107, which is located facing the UCSD Town Square, just south and west of the Price Center.
We here at The Final Straw are soliciting sticker, poster, and logo designs to provide fascinating swag for our listeners. The design must include our web address, thefinalstrawradio.noblogs.org, our show name, and imagery reflecting the nature of the radio show. Chosen artists will receive gifts of t-shirts and other anarchy goodies. You can email your designs in PDF form to bursts@ashevillefm.org, or a physical copy can be sent to The Final Straw, care of Asheville FM, 864 Haywood Road, Asheville, North Carolina, 28806.
A reminder, the Ku Klux Klan has called for a rally at the steps of the state capital of South Carolina in Columbia on Saturday the 18th at 3 p.m. Folks are planning a counter-demonstration on the day to make it known that these jokers are not welcome in the streets. Check out columbiascdemocallout.tumblr.com for more info, or follow them on their Twitter handle, at antiracistsc. From their site. On Saturday, July 18th, the local White Knights of the Ku Klux Klan will assemble on the State House grounds in Columbia, South Carolina, and we will confront them. This rally is part of a recent wave of anti-Black terror, from the Charleston massacre to the arson of Black churches, that has strategically sought to build upon white racist backlash against the hashtag Black Lives Matter, anti-police uprisings of the past year. We call upon all those who can hashtag Black Lives Matter activists, community organizers, anti-racists, anarchists and other radicals, and anyone else furious with racism and the police to converge in Columbia, confront the Klan, and defy their message of white supremacy. History has shown, from the armed standoff against a lynch mob in Columbia, Tennessee, in 1946, to the 1958 Battle of the Hayes Pond, from the Deacons for Defense to the armed defiance of Monroe, North Carolina's NAACP chapter, from the 1979 Greensboro Massacre to the 1997 confrontation with the Klan in downtown Asheville, North Carolina, that we must oppose white supremacist organizing actively and physically in our streets and neighborhoods. The KKK is only a small group whose ability to inflict racist violence actually pales in comparison to that of structures of oppression like the police, the economy, and the state. But the sentiment that groups like the KKK hold runs deep through the currents of whiteness in this country and is a major obstacle to our struggles against these larger structures. Explicit manifestations of white supremacy like the Klan are only one way that the state will seek to contain the Black Lives Matter organizing and anti-police riots of the last year. At this historic juncture, a large Klan rally in the South cannot go unchallenged. Bring banners, bring a friend, and bring your anger and rage against the white supremacy that courses through the veins of this society. See you in Columbia.
Along the lines of last week's announcement of great audio projects to check out outside of Asheville, we'd like to suggest folks interested in a fantastic North American prison-related show give a listen to The Prison Radio Show on CKUT out of McGill University in Montreal. The show airs on the second Thursday of every month between 5 and 6 p.m. Central Standard Time as part of CKUT's News' Off the Hour segment, and also airs the fourth Friday of every month between 11 and 12 CST. More at prisonradioshow.wordpress.com. Also, for a great look at audio anarchy in the Philippines, and to see what this week's guests typically work on, you can check out the pirate radio station Radio Itim at https://radioitim.wordpress.com or at 107.9 FM if you're listening in Davao.
Out of Middleton, Connecticut's Wesleyan University, WESU hosts a show called Anarchy on Air, a student anarchist collective radio show featuring interviews, panels, action updates, and more. The show was formerly incarnated as the Horizontal Power Hour. This show and more can be found at anarchyonairwesu.tumblr.com, and it can be heard the second and fourth Tuesdays at 4 to 4:45 p.m. Eastern Standard Time.
Anarcho-primitivist and philosopher John Zerzan co-hosts the weekly, years-running, hour-long radio show Anarchy Radio on 88.1 KWVA at the University of Oregon in Eugene. Check out archives of the show at johnzerzan.net/radio to hear him and his co-hosts discuss recent news around technology, school shootings, alienation, ecological destruction, and other things. The show airs Tuesdays at 7 p.m. Pacific Standard Time, and you can express your views by calling into the live broadcast 541-346-0645. And now a word from Sean Swain. What you say, what you say, what you say,
what? Record like a bomb! Trolls online have accused me of being both a Marxist-Leninist and a vanguardist because I defend the strategy of guerrilla warfare. Apparently, it is Marxist and vanguardist to advocate strategies that work. To be clear, I don't advocate a strategy of exclusive guerrilla warfare. That is, I'm an insurrectionist at heart. But I recognize that where insurrections occur, they can be carried further if a wide variety of other strategies are undertaken at the same time, like sabotage campaigns, worker strikes, and armed attacks against the enemy's symbols of power. For some reason, in modern times, Marxist-Leninists have cornered the market on guerrilla warfare. As a consequence, when most people think of guerrilla fighters, they imagine Marxist-Leninists with rank and hierarchy. They imagine that Fidel Castro represents every guerrilla, but that's simply not the case. Spartacus led the largest slave revolt in history and destabilized the Roman Empire, mostly relying on guerrilla strategies. American colonists revolted using the guerrilla tactics they learned from Native Americans. The Lakota defeated the U.S. in three consecutive engagements using guerrilla warfare, something the Marxists of Viet Cong couldn't even do. So, if you have to be a Marxist-Leninist to fight in a way that works, Tecumseh, Crazy Horse, and Geronimo got the memo. Why is it that Marxist-Leninists cornered the market on guerrilla warfare? Clearly, they're better at having fun than we are. And that takes us to the vanguardist argument. As that argument goes, being a guerrilla requires certain skills that everyone doesn't have, and it requires arms that everyone doesn't own. So, those who participate in guerrilla warfare, the argument goes, become a power elite, a group of hotshots with more prestige than others. While I think that may be true in some places, it certainly isn't true in the U.S. There are 200 million firearms in the United States. We've got guns coming out of our ears. So if you don't own one, it's because you don't want one. There are basketball shoes that cost more than most guns, so by this argument, basketball players are vanguardists too. As for special skills, I think there are more complicated skill sets for making and throwing Molotov cocktails. You need to know the mixture of gas to styrofoam, know how to score the bottle so it breaks, and how to throw it effectively to hit a target. I should think folks who play baseball have a distinct advantage to hit something they're aiming at. So, those who throw Molotovs are vanguardists too. Right? Look, a rifle is a tool. So is a Molotov cocktail. Rifles are inexpensive, available, and fairly easy to use. The fact is, we're so steeped in pacifism that we latch onto any argument for not picking up a rifle. Those who scream vanguardism are attempting to be pacifists without the pacifism, preventing recourse to one of the many strategies that can contribute to our liberation. It makes no rational sense to propose fighting an enemy who has rifles while you go without them. It makes no sense to not at least explore the possibility of using firearms. As someone proficient with firearms, I would suggest that every anarchist should learn how to shoot. Then, if you decide not to pick up a rifle, it's because you made that choice, not because the choice was made for you. There's empowerment in increasing your skill sets. Imagine if folks pulled into Ferguson with a truckload of rifles and the know-how to quickly teach rebels how to be reasonably effective with them. It's no more vanguardist than pulling up with a truck full of Molotovs. If we don't avail ourselves to the opportunity to develop firearms proficiencies and hurl the words Marxist and vanguardist at those who do, we potentially relegate ourselves to preventable failure after preventable failure, sitting next to the pacifists, waiting for the real Marxist vanguardist to come along and do what we can't. And then we're stuck with their stupid program. This is anarchist prisoner Sean Swain from inside the American torture complex. If you're listening, you are the resistance.
You can write to Sean Swain at seanswain243-205, P.O. Box 45699, 1724 State Route number 728, Lucasville, Ohio 45699. To read some of Sean's writing and learn more about his case, check out seanswain.org. Would you all care to introduce yourselves to tell listeners where you're from and what projects you're involved in?
Sure. My name is Len, and I'm from Davao, and I'm with Maharlika and Tikal Emergence.
And I'm Cha. I'm also from Davao, and I'm with Maharlika and Tikal Emergence since the beginning.
Hi, I'm Babo, and I'm a full-time volunteer here at Maharlika Integral Emergence.
And this is Charlie. I'm also a full-time volunteer in MIE since last year.
And what is MIE?
MIE is Maharlika Integral Emergence. We're all from Davao, and basically we do three major projects right now. But in the past, we've been running InfoShop for around 4 years with the space, and 3 years without the space, and we've been running in-house and outdoor project in the past, like community library, book clubs and film clubs, free school and open kitchen. That also includes vegan nights, art and music events, skill sharing workshops, personal and collective healing projects like yoga, acupuncture, meditation, mental health. We also do eco-camping, eco-defense projects, and many others.
That's a lot. I was trying to type out what you were saying.
I can speak more.
Yeah, please do.
Another thing we do is eco camping. We also do integration with indigenous cultures and tribal communities on the issue of mining, corporate agribusiness, GMO, and we also did a Southeast Asia solidarity network building in the past. So right now we actually kind of restructured how we initiate our projects, and we're actually coming from a post-anarchist perspective. It's a more integrated, more inclusive, and holistic embracing approach.
That's amazing. Can you talk about some of the, I'm really excited to hear about the working with indigenous folks and the building of that solidarity network. There's been the outgrowth in Europe and parts of North Africa to integrate, or at least to build communication and solidarity between different anti-land occupation projects like the Notav in northern Italy and the Zods in France and the Hambach Forest in Germany. So I'd love to hear more about that network.
Sure. Way back in 2002, we did a solidarity project with Earth First Leeds in the UK. And it was more of a community solidarity project with indigenous villages who are threatened by agribusiness plantations and corporate aggression projects. So we did that with several tribes here in Davao and a few more in Luzon. So basically it was like an international solidarity network where we can do protests in the UK at the same time here in Philippines.
Was that also known as the South Pacific Solidarity Project? Because I've heard that written up in Do or Die magazine, which came out around that time too.
Yes, that's it. And also, aside from that, way back in 2005, we helped local NGOs and local farmers fight against Monsanto and GMO in general. And we also did protests against aerial spraying of agribusiness and also mining issues, 7 different communities in the entire archipelago. So it was basically a video and text and audio documentation of human rights and environmental abuses of corporations against the communities that are directly affected by corporate aggression.
Who is the expected audience for the video and the text? Was it for other activists and communities around, or for NGOs or the UN or governments?
It's basically the general public. We produce a material which I can send you after this call, and it's just a journal. Actually, the videos are not yet finished, but the journal is finished, so I can send you a copy of that.
That would be amazing. So for many listeners in the United States, the Philippines is sort of an unknown territory. Can you all talk a bit about where Davao is in the archipelago and who lives there and what the city looks like?
Yeah, definitely. Philippines is an archipelago having about 7,107 islands, and it is located in the Southeast Asia, south of China, east of Singapore, north of Australia. So Philippines, in Philippines, the majority of Christians in Southeast Asia lives here, and 86% of the population is Roman Catholic, and 6% are in Christian cults. So Davao is situated in the southwestern part of the Philippine archipelago, which is in the southeast part of the Philippine archipelago, and that's in the island of Mindanao. So the word Davao is a toponym, and it came from the early inhabitants of the place. So the early tribes of the landscape describing the river Davao, then Davao, and so Davao. So Davao was originally inhabited by early tribes like Muslim people or Muslim tribes, Bagobo, Manobo, and several others. Now 10 tribes, which are Daata, Matigsalog, Ovo Manobo, Klatajanga, Tagabawa, Tausug, Maguindanao, Maranao, Kagan, and Sama. So at the present, it is a melting pot of ethnicities, a mixture of different ethno-linguistic, cultural and religious background. So there are 8 major Christian religions, and there are 5 varieties. These are the Islam, Buddhism, Sikh, Judaism, Hinduism, Animism. Geographically, it is about 1.4 million inhabitants, and the landscape includes mountains, flatlands, and coastal areas, about 2,444 square kilometers.
Economic-wise, the region is mostly agricultural, with patches of urbanized areas where many people dwell. Generally, the entire archipelago is made up of small units of villages, and we call that barangays, which is around 42,208. Government system is unitary or presidential state. Constitutional republic, patterned from U.S. government system. There are tons of indigenous culture who are struggling for self determination and economic independence. And there are also post-mainstream people from cities who are regreening areas by means of sharing garden and permaculture. Political-wise, the political structure of the archipelago is populated land-based, a dynasty type of power structure. The state enforces a multi-party system that endorses people from the elite class with regards to the political spectrum. We have a huge movement of the authoritarian left with two major factions or our political blocks, the rejectionists and reaffirmists. We also have indigenous culture and economic independence groups like Cordillera People's Alliance in the north, and in the south, Bangsamoro Liberation Groups like MILF, MNLF, BIFF, and in between the spectrum are far left to post-left groups like the anarchist eco-defense groups and mainstream environmental and human rights groups. Currently, there are about 11 info shops or social centers in the Philippines, 2 in Davao, 9 in Luzon. So several collectives and anarchist circles are doing different initiatives like online radio, like Radio Itim. There are many Food Not Bombs groups in different areas from north to south. And there are groups who are doing Buy Nothing Day, Critical Mass, Free Market, Container Gardening, Urban Gardening, Permaculture, Alternative Energy or like solar or biogas, Independent Publishing, Distro, and many others.
In an interview that I read recently, and I can point listeners to this later, but an interview that I read, I think it was actually published maybe in 2012, and it's on Libcom. The person being interviewed, I believe was in Davao, was talking about the difficulty of getting anarchist literature within the Philippines that was in any of the indigenous languages, or even in Spanish. Does this continue to be an issue that the independent publishing is trying to counter?
Yeah, most of the published materials coming from anarchist circles or post-left groups are published mostly in English. But there are some groups who are doing translation projects.
We do.
And we're translating anarchist literature into the local language. But actually, Babo will add more about Davao.
Oh, hello, I'm Babo. And crime-wise, Davao is famous for extrajudicial killings or summary executions because of our mayor, very famous mayor, Rodrigo Duterte. And approximately, there were 1,000 or maybe even more people dead from that. It has a history of violence in the 80s during the martial law era, Marcos era in the 80s. And right now, concerning the crime situation, it is a state of negative peace where many people were killed in the past until present, and people are passive, apathetic, or afraid to confront the local government. And ecology-wise, Davao has lots of lush mountains, long coastal areas, 8 major watersheds, and has the highest peak elevation in the entire Philippines, 9,069 feet, and we have a good biodiversity, but we have several endangered species, especially the Philippine eagle. And right now, they are threatened by expansion of agricultural business, and now there's a coal power plant here in Davao, watershed contamination due to harmful chemicals from aerial spraying of commercial agribusiness. For some people, floods are a way of life. There's a threat of landslides from urban sprawl, displacement of urban communities, unhealthy local practices like poaching, slash and burn system, garbage problems, and many others.
All right, and also, Bruce, regarding the name Philippines, we don't really subscribe to the name as it is stands for the colonial rule of King Philip II of Spain, coined by a guy named Roy Lopez de Villalobos during the Spanish era. The name Philippines is disseminating psycho-cultural exploitation in the midst of the populace as they are reminded by the colonial domination. So we prefer to call it Maharlika, which etymologically means Great Creation. It is also a local linguistic expression, not promoting any blemish of patriotism and nationalism, but local empowerment, linguistic, and cultural expression.
Then I will correct myself from now on and call it Maharlika. What language is that devised from? Is that like kind of shared enough among the peoples of some of the larger islands or just one community?
You can find the word Maharlika in all islands, three major islands.
Can you give a brief rundown of the modern history of anarchism in Maharlika? For instance, there's a long entrenched authoritarian left in the country which has faced a lot of oppression in the past. Does anarchism stretch back as far or as strong as do communist and socialist parties?
Sure. I'm just going to reference one of our comrades writing, Basu Mali. And he has written a material called Archipelagic Confederation, Advancing Genuine Citizens Politics Through Free Assemblies and Independent Structures from the Barangays and Communities. So, quote, the revolutionary tradition in the country was enriched upon the arrival of Isabelo de los Reyes in Manila in 1901 from his exile in Barcelona, Spain, where he brought a collection of books, including some authored by Malatesta, Proudhon, Kropotkin, Marx, Darwin, Aquinas, and Voltaire. This was followed by a successful wave of protests and strikes within and around Manila that paved the way for establishment of the UOD, the first anarchist union called Union Obrera Democratica. And this marked the shift of the revolutionary struggle from a mere nationalist to an imperialist, anti-imperialist one. And the UOD disintegrated in 1903 from its remains. Socialist Party was established in 1938, which later led the Hukbalahap guerrilla movement. And they were the foremost opponents of the Japanese forces prior to the reinforcement provided by the Americans. This was also the period where the revolutionary movement began to feel Bolshevik influence. The tradition of struggle later proceeded to the establishment of the Maoist-influenced Communist Party in the late 1960s, which adopted a nationalist strategy and protracted the People's War. It gained enormous support in the masses, but it failed to grab power until its fragmentation into smaller party formations due to the split in 1992, unquote. So historically, if we look at the early tribes of the archipelago from a green and eco-anarchist perspective, tribes, particularly the hunter-gatherer ones, have long been autonomous and free of state and religion. They thrive in the mountains and coastal areas in different parts of the archipelago for centuries. In many societies, women were equal with men and played the role of village healers called babaylan, or local shamans. But this does not represent the entire picture of the pre-colonial era, because there were many tribes who were capturing and selling slaves. The Tausug tribe, particularly in Mindanao, had a slave-based economy for many years, and there were also many active raids in part of the mid-Philippines, which is Visayas, and there were also clan wars, tribal wars, and many other atrocities. So in general, in some parts, there were egalitarian societies, while the societies at large are comprised of barangays, whom Somali states had direct democracy, freedom of assembly, and decentralized decision-making process. There were also independent and loosely federated areas of trade and commerce. So, added to that, according to an interview of Basumali, he states that primitive social organizations continuously evolved until social stratifications formed and became institutions. The archipelago has various tribes with their own self-identity, culture, and socio-political organization. Before authoritarianism infected the revolutionary movement of the archipelago, direct action was already practiced. Many autonomous and independent factions in the entire archipelago fought colonial powers. Struggle was not only limited to men in huge anti-colonial movements, but there were also women in different parts. The contemporary anti-authoritarian and autonomous movements in particular is composed of different info shops and collectives and individuals that were originally part of either the 80s or 90s movements from the anarcho-punk scene or post-left groups who were either disgruntled with their scenes or just transcended their previous movements. It is not really known if there are any connections between the early 19th century unions and the current anarchist stream, or if there were any anti-authoritarian thought and praxis between those periods. It is thought that the anti-authoritarian politics somehow recovered its position in the punk scene in the 80s and post-left movements of the anti-WTO movement in the 90s. All we know for sure is the movement is expanding in its theory and praxis.
These are incredibly concise answers. How has punk interacted with anarchism in the Philippines? Do you see it as aiding the spread of the philosophy, or does it hinder the development past a subculture?
Sure. Like what I mentioned, the anti-authoritarian thought and practice kind of recovers its position in the punk scene in the 80s and influenced the post-left movements in the 90s in the early 2000s. So I can only really speak about the Davao context with regards to your question. So in Davao, the anarchist thought and practice independently sprung from the punk scene. In 1994, there was a movement called Rebel Tribe. That was like the birth of DIY zines and t-shirts, matter of stuff.
You're listening to The Final Straw Radio on WSFM LP 103.3 Asheville and on ashevillefm.org. We're featuring a conversation with members of an anarchist collective in Davao in Maharlika, or so-called Philippines, about collective struggles, ideas, and their social space called Maharlika Integral Emergence. More after this break.
Well, you all have mentioned post-left a couple of times during the conversation, and while I'm familiar with the context of post-left politics in North America, in the English-speaking parts of North America at least, would you care to go into a little more detail about how you experience it or how it appears in Maharlika or in Davao in particular?
Most of the Maharlika integral people are coming from either the punk scene or from post-mainstream politics worldview. And what I was referring to when I said post-left was mostly people from Luzon. There were many people who came from the mainstream authoritarian left who were disillusioned by their politics and by their practice. So they kind of, you know, transcended their politics into a more egalitarian, so the anarchist circles. So I'm going to continue with the Davao context of punk and anarchism.
Well, in regards to your question about do you see it as aiding the spread of philosophy or does it hinder development past of a past subculture? I think basically for me, I think it helped. The punk scene helped a lot about the introduction of anarchism to the young ones, to the kids. And basically also it hinders the spread of anarchism also because it tends to be a ghetto, like a closed group. It tends to be an exclusive group, so that's why right now we're spreading anarchism through.
I'm just gonna continue. I'll give you like a brief chronology of how the Davao anarcho-punk / anarchist movement started in Davao. So it was way back in 1994 when a group of people kind of started the punk scene, and there was a birth of DIY ethics, so there was zines and t-shirts and many others. And that went on for 6 years. There was also influence from other bands from Japan and the Europe who came here, who brought ideas about Funat Bombs and Earth First and many others. So in 2000, there was Southern Solidarity and Davao Anarcho Peace Punks. And in 2002 and 2003, there was the birth of Davao Anarchist Resistance Movement, which comprised of Earth First Davao, Food Not Bombs Davao, and Animal Resistance Davao. And in 2003, we did solidarity projects with indigenous communities, and there was info shops, there was translation projects and publishing projects, and many more. With regards to your question as, do you see it as aiding the spread of philosophy or does it hinder a development past a subculture? I think both. On one hand, yes, in some scenes, because the tendency of people to get attracted to post-mainstream politics and culture. And on the other hand, there is a strong anti-intellectual culture in several places that hinders its development, and that is very prominent in many circles.
Those are definitely critiques that we hear in the U.S. and Canada about it, too. And it's a funny and interesting discussion to have. Like, there's so many people that I've talked to who that's how they came into anarchism, which is not the case for me. But I came from like a Catholic perspective into anti-death penalty and then into protesting war in Serbia and so on until I finally moved to anarchism. This is an off-script question, but and if it doesn't make any sense, that's totally fine. But within the United States context, I know there's been a lot of ostensibly post-left anarchism, like primitivism, coming from Christian circles. So I'm wondering, is there any overlap that you're aware of in Maharlika between Christianity, Islam, or other religions and the shaping of anarchism as it exists? Or is mostly anarchism atheist?
Most of the people who established Maharlika or who was in there in the establishment of Maharlika Integral were coming from the anarcho-punk anarchist movements. And there were also people from nuclear families who transcended their previous conditions and embraced a different form of worldview. And I would say that our approach and our theory and praxis is mostly coming from a post-anarchist perspective. So that could mean that we kind of integrate different ideologies and different approaches and make it like a more holistic and all-embracing approach towards our projects, towards how we deal with people, towards running the infrashop and projects in general. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. The static got really loud right then. I think I picked up the response.
First, do you hear some background noise?
Yeah, the background noise is totally fine. It sounds like there's like a loose wire, maybe. Like, I'm not hearing it right now, but it kind of ebbs and flows a little bit.
Added to that, individually we have different views, but the Maharlika Integral at large is coming from a post-dogmatic, post-mythic religion. But we have our own spiritual practices, which kind of integrates different wisdom traditions like meditation, yoga, and we also do workshops on that and help people learn that, and also invite people who are into that to share their skills and their techniques.
So in the North American this is kind of a playoff of the question about debates going on in the anarchist circles, but in the North American context, there's been this long-standing, sometimes is happening, sometimes isn't, but conflict between red anarchists and green anarchists, or like the, you know, the labor focused versus the ecological end of civilization side. And it seems like if y'all are kind of steeped in a post-left or post-anarchist perspective, that might not be so much the case, that there's debates or that there's at least strife going on within the communities or the milieus. But is that actually true? And also in wider Maharlika, do you find that to be that there's major splits between anarchist factions?
Yes, I think so. Every infoshop and every collective holds their different theory and practice, but it's not really as big as the North American anarchist movement. When it comes to strife, we don't have any of that. It's more of an embryonic movement right now. And the infoshops are bringing different projects and organizing gatherings and, you know, sharing different approaches and experiences. So that's basically an embryonic movement. It's just starting to grow.
Maybe we can talk a little bit about the South Pacific Solidarity Network. If anyone has experience that they want to talk about a little more with what's going on with that, and maybe mentioning some struggles that folks are aware of and in solidarity with in other parts of Southeast Asia.
Actually, the Southern Solidarity Pacific is it's not anymore existing with regards to our solidarity with the UK guys. But we have our different projects, and I'm sure they have their own, theirs. And yeah, we did different community integration in the past, back in 2010, 2011. And we went to different communities who were directly affected by mining issues and corporate aggression projects. And we did a documentation. And that's basically, we also produce a material where people can access information about what's happening in those places, and that's basically it. With regards to networking between anarchists and neighboring countries, in 2009 we took an initiative called CSON, or it's CSON, it's called Southeast Asia Autonomous Network. But prior to that, there were attempts. There was the Asian Anarchist Network, there's the RISOM Anarchist Network. But what I can talk about is the CIASM. It was basically an attempt to network other collective info shops and individuals in Southeast Asia, particularly Indonesia and Malaysia, collectives and individuals sharing the same theory in practice. And we had a website for this, and people were starting to post things in the website. In part, it was successful for a while because it was organic and it was done in a face-to-face communication basis. But for some reason, the inter-region network seemed to have failed in the first several attempts. So that's what I can talk about with regards to networking in Southeast Asia.
Would you all care to talk a little more specifically about the indigenous and rural support work that's being done and some of the any of the specific anti-mining projects that might be of interest to listeners abroad who maybe are struggling against some of the same corporations but in their own home countries?
Sure. Let me just pull out some material here. Okay. The communities that we visited are mostly in Luzon. It's in the northern part of the Philippine archipelago. And some of them are struggling against Canadian mining corporations. And one is from the US, I think. And some are struggling against Australian mining companies and Korean mining companies, but mostly from Canadian corporations. So if you want me to elaborate some of the corporations, I can.
That would be great.
Okay. One notorious mining company is Felix Mining Company. It's they hide their true name under local names. Like, they operate in the north and in the south, and they have destroyed communities and farmers' lands and trust amongst people in the community. And they committed human rights abuses and environmental damage, especially in parts of Surigao, parts of Benguet in Luzon. Another one is BHP Billiton. It's an Australian mining company, and it's, you know, it's I generally, there were like 700 people or more who were dead from anti-mining related activities. And what the government does is to strongly enforce this industry and make it like a flagship of Philippines. So we're just doing our part to help those communities who are directly affected by broadcasting their issue in the international arena.
So this might be a non-starter question. You might not be able to go anywhere with it because it's I'm referring to a specific theoretical positioning that I've been hearing over the last maybe decade in North America or Turtle Island. But the term decolonization has been on a lot of anti-authoritarian and anarchist tongues recently in English-speaking North America, where there's definitely a different context in terms of what colonization has and continues to look like than in Maharlika. Is that term being used there, and how is it being used?
In some circles, it is being used, and I think they just refer to the attempt of not having an identity of the colonial, basing from the colonial or coming from the colonial rule. But with regards to our group, Maharlika itself is like a cultural work. It's like an education campaign to decolonize the identity that was imposed for in the last 300 plus years by colonial powers. And so we're trying to avoid the name Philippines because it refers to the colonial rule of King Philip II in the Spanish era. The coming years, we're going to do some cultural and research about how it started and the literatures of the pre-colonial era and kind of recover that and try to make a digital library where people can access that.
That's fascinating. You have talked about so much so far, and I've just gone through all the questions. So in terms of the work that people are doing to give solidarity to block extractive industries like mining that can be horribly polluting and can evict people off of their land and make their, you know, the land untenable to be able to carry them, to be able to live on it. Can you talk about, for instance, you were mentioning permaculture, what permaculture practices look like in Maharlika and in the projects that you all are aware of working with indigenous rural folks in areas that are in danger of being removed by extractive industries?
Sure. With regards to Maharlika, we're actually located in an urban area and we don't have land. So we're quite struggling to find soil. And what we do is just container gardening and just try to maximize the area that we have and try to put plants and vegetables. And we also do solar energy. But some collectives like Feral Crush is kind of looking into having a permaculture place where they can be sustainable. And I'm not sure about your question about the indigenous communities being evicted. Can you please rephrase that?
Oh, Well, I was, because I don't know the specifics, I'm kind of going off of an assumption, but at least in a lot of places in North America, oftentimes, frequently, extractive industries are moved in to extract resources from areas that indigenous people are on, which leads to the poisoning of that land, also the eviction of those populations, and the creation of an environment afterwards where basically people become either refugees or poisoned by the process. For instance, in Black Mesa in Arizona with uranium mining that's been going on since the 50s, but there's also uranium storage, spent uranium storage on the land, which is increasing cancer rates there. I was wondering if, I would assume that people in those communities, maybe it's an unfair assumption to put those two things together, indigeneity and being on the land with extractive resources. That may not be the case there. But I'm wondering where those are proposed job creators for, even if short-term, job creators for the populations where those extractions are going to happen. Have you all been offering any sort of skill sets that might counterbalance and make people in those communities offer new opportunities for economic survival outside of extraction? Does that make sense?
What we, because our skill set are mainly in advocacy campaigns and doing documentations of text and video and audio. But some other groups within our networks are helping farming communities, for example, who are using synthetic chemicals to shift to an organic method. And that has been done in several communities in the Philippines where they were affected by corporate Canadian mining companies. And I think that's still an ongoing effort to move away from the mainstream spectrum of economic survival.
Are there any things that we haven't talked about that you think that listeners of the show might find compelling or interesting? That, I mean, there's a very good chance, because I know so little about Maharlika that I just don't know other questions to ask.
Yeah, regarding to the sustainability project, that is also a concern here, especially for those folks we have in mountains, because of the effects of some private companies doing mining, whatever extraction that they do, and make the community suffer. So there are, Lan said, there are groups that conduct some seminars or awareness and workshops about how to be sustainable. For example, one is the UCG, or the Urban Container Gardening. It's a group of people here in Davao and also in general in the Philippines, Maharlika, that they conduct workshops to democratize the food every people, instead of relying mostly on buying, being consumer. So here, using the UCG or Urban Container Gardening system, is people in every family, and every family is becoming sustainable and having a daily food in their houses. So I think that's also an interesting thing here, and it is emerging. Actually, we do some composting and some fertilizing in an organic way. So I think people there in the U.S. or some other who will listen to this program will be interested in investing on UCG or Urban Container Gardening, especially to urban people here.
Yeah, definitely for a lot of people in the United States, access to land is not something that they have because of the cost of actually owning property. And a lot of people live in the city, so that's a good idea.
Yeah.
I know in the United States, there's a lot of, especially among urban populations, and in particular, urban populations of color, there is this phenomenon that's often described as a food desert, where the only foods that are really available are very, very processed foods that you can buy from a bodega, you know, like fried potato chips and white bread and things that are really not very healthful, but a lack of fruits and vegetables and unprocessed grains and things that people can consume a little more healthily. Is that sort of phenomenon happen in Davao and other large cities?
Yes, not really that big, but it's emerging. In the case of having a mainstream programs promoting instant things, instant food, instant coffee, instant everything is in instant and make life so instant. So I think, yeah, it is also a problem here, especially for kids or the youth, because they are more susceptible to being deceived by these type of so-called food. So yeah, Yeah, right.
Sad to know that that's a thing all over the world, I'm sure.
Yeah.
I think if you look up the internet and search about Maharlika, you can definitely find some things about Philippines. And many companies and many organizations use the word Maharlika, but we refer it to some specific historical and linguistic expression that people had in the past. And it's not the same. I mean, we don't have the same position as other info shops with regards to the name Maharlika. But we have some networks who are advocating this campaign. And there are two main advocacy groups with regards to the name Maharlika. One is based on conspiracy theories, and one is what we hold. So I just want to make things clear that if somebody wants to look up Maharlika. And another thing that I would like to add is our approach, because we kind of like grew up in terms of practice and theory. And we, like before, we used to really reject different approaches and be really Puritan anarchist in terms of theory and practice. But right now we kind of transcended that and we base our perspective from a more holistic approach, which kind of embraces all different perspectives and try to address them in different levels. So what I'm basically saying is that we try to make our theory and practice more holistic in as much as we can in and outside the info shop.
How does the info shop function internally, and how is it sustained materially?
What we found out in the past 4 years is that there are three aspects of the info shop life and the collective living in the context of Philippines, and I think so it could also apply in different places. And they are, first, domestic tasks. People will have to deal with domestic things. And second is projects. And the third is interpersonal relationship. So we're really coming from different cultural backgrounds and families and values and personalities. And we found a way to somehow address that and harmonize things, our values and our personality. So we do a weekly meeting where we try to address different, evaluate the activities of the previous week and try to address any interpersonal relationship and discomforts. So we try to avoid judgments during the conversation, try to be open and honest as much as we can to really address the root of the issue. And we try to keep it on a weekly basis so we can keep things healthy. That's how we basically function internally. And externally, we've been supported by different groups and info shops and individuals in the UK and Europe and the US in the past 4 years. Right now, we're trying to be self-sustaining. So we actually work and just contribute for the rent and bills. So that's how we sustain it.
And collective meals, I would imagine, are like a part of the two of those things put together, right?
Yeah. Before we had to, our meals were completely collective, but right now it's didn't really work because of participation issues and, you know, things like that. So we have collective meals occasionally. I mean, every week we have one at least.
How many people are involved in the project?
Right now it's 7.
That's great. Do you have a website for it? It looked like maybe there were some Facebook pages for it.
I can give you our website with regards to our work about the mining issue. But our website in Maharlika is, we still have to repurchase the domain, the web host, so I guess that could take us a week to send you the link.
Okay, that's no worries. I look forward to seeing that material. I've really, really enjoyed speaking with y'all, Lan, Cha, Charlie, and Babo, correct?
Yeah.
All right. Y'all seem like really sweet people, and I hope I get to meet you at some point.
Yeah, that would be great.
I wish you the best of luck and to a world without borders and capitalism and hierarchy and patriarchy and all those other nasty things. Take care of yourselves. And if there's anything that ever comes up that you think English speakers in North America should hear about from the Philippines, I would love to help make that happen, whether it be my project or the Crime Think podcast or a few other projects.
Yeah, of course.
Okay.
We actually did a translation project with Crime Think. Their video of To Change Everything. I can also send you the link to that. But it's in our local language.
That's great. That's funny. It's such a small world.
Yeah, but the target audience for that is the local. Yeah, that's why we translated it.
That's great. I know I just said like, okay, we'll stop talking. But is what kind of writing is being produced in the local language that's not just translation from other languages? Can you talk about any of the any of the sorts of top subject matter, or like whether practical or theoretical, that folks in either Mahalika or in your community are working on that you find exciting or interesting?
We will be producing many retail materials in the future when we will come to a point where we do the cultural research and sociopolitical research. But right now, what we produce is just newsletters. And I guess I'll also send you that link. I'll send you everything.
Okay, that sounds lovely. Thanks again for having the conversation. And I hope you all have a lovely day.
You too.
Thank you.
All right, thank you.
Asheville FM on WSFM LP 103.3 in Asheville. This is The Final Straw, and I'm William Goodenough.
And I'm Bruce O'Goodness.
The show can also be heard on KXCF in Marshall, California, KWTF in Bodega Bay, California, KOWALP in Olympia, Washington, WCRSLP in Columbus, Ohio, and Berkeley Liberation Radio. Archives of this show can be heard a week after broadcast at thefinalstrawradio.noblogs.org, and is podcasting at radioforall.net. You can email us at thefinalstrawradio@riseup.net with questions or comments, and you can write us snail mail at The Final Straw, care of Asheville FM, 864 Haywood Road, Asheville, North Carolina, 28806. If you're listening live, stay tuned for DJ Jake with Onward Through the Fog, a laid-back music show from 3 to 5 every Sunday.